Okay, we, as I said before, we're going to, this is sort of in the IRAC method here. We've stated the rule, now we're doing the A in the IRAC method of applying. Let's start with the restaurant case here, Markle. Somebody tell us about, go ahead, Ms. Pierce.
The plaintiff is Mr. Markle, who went, this is July 1986, went to a shopping center, and the purpose was for him to go to the Mexican restaurant to eat. While he was in the parking lot, he saw a fellow employee, so he had a pulled up next to him in the parking spot, and was chatting. The plaintiff had some steel in the back of his truck that he was to transfer to this other guy, so he pulled up next to him. And as he was transferring the piece of steel, he stepped in a truck hole in the parking lot with some white foot, and allegedly sustained injury as a result of the fall. The central issue of the trial court case is whether he was inviting the trespasser.
How can he be a trespasser?
Okay, but actually there's a way he could become a trespasser. How, what would he have to do to become a trespasser? Yeah, he could be doing something, you know, let's say, for example, he, you know, goes to some part of the premises where he doesn't have permission, or, you know, he's using, there's a fire hydrant there, or there's, you know, he's using the sprinkler system to wash off some parts. You know, he's doing something where you would say, gee, this is outside the scope of what he's been given permission to do. Obviously didn't happen here, but it's not, you know, cases where, for example, there's a sign that says employees only. You know, you're looking for the restroom or you're trying to get somebody's attention and you go someplace, well, maybe you've gone beyond what your permission was extended. Okay, so, but the real question here is, did he cease to be an invitee at some point? And the restaurant's argument is what?
Well, the trial court did grant summary judgment in favor of the restaurant and other defendants, basically the shopping center, because they concluded that there was no material dispute as to the fact that the matter of law and could be granted. And the trial court said that they determined he was a licensee at the time of the accident.
Why? What had happened here? He starts there going there to dine, but...
But there was some, I think they talked about incidental activity in relation to why he took the
right. Event. We're not in the steel sample business, yeah. The restaurant would say. You know, if he slips and falls on the linoleum or on a tear in the carpet or if he burns himself on the hot water in the restroom or something like that, yeah, that's part of what we do, but hey, he was doing his own business here. What's the court's answer to that?
The trial court did say that he was a licensee at the time of the accident, and that the only affirmative duty that Mangler owed him was to refrain from willfully or wantonly injuring him in a way.
Yeah, the better way to say that, actually, would be to say that they have a duty to warn him of hidden perils. And the reason they wind up using that phrase is the implication that if you fail to warn, that's... Okay, so, but he still wants to be considered an invitee. And what does this court say on his argument that he remained an invitee?
They agreed with him. They reversed the trial court decision, and the plaintiff contended that, friends with each other in the shopping center.
Right.
That this incidental activity is something that somebody should expect to happen, trying to happen, but it could happen. And
sure.
And that's why shopping centers exist, because people are going to run into each other.
Right. If you invite somebody to join you for lunch at, you know, a restaurant downtown or whatever, you're there partly to eat, but you're also there to engage in, you know, social activity. You're going to exchange, you know, information, emotions, what have you. When people are on the owner's premises for that owner's business purpose, they will at the same time engage in other kinds of things. They'll change their kids' diapers, or they'll whatever it is, check their cell phone messages. They'll do all kinds of other things that are not directly the business of the owner, but can reasonably be expected to take place. So the real question is whether this guy was even there pursuant to the owner's business purpose. Suppose in this case he happened to see the guy, but suppose it had been that he needed to make this transfer. He's got a steel sample, he needs to get to this guy, and they're trying to figure out, well, you know, where can we do this? And they say, hey, you know that Hacienda Mexican restaurant that's in the shopping center? Why don't we meet there in the parking lot? Or, to take another example, suppose you're working downtown for a law firm over the summer, and you're talking to somebody, hey, let's have lunch together. Well, where do you want to meet? Well, why don't you meet me at the Barnes & Noble or the B. Dalton Books, over in the history section or something. Would that be pursuant to a business purpose? Here he clearly went there to go to the restaurant. Before he could get to the restaurant, he hurt himself. Had it not been for this little exchange, he would have eventually dined there. What happens if my kids are bored on a February morning and it's, you know, too late to go, there's no snow on the ground, we can't go sledding, that's still yucky out, I decide I'm going to go to the boat show and let my kids run around at the boat show. And it's free, it happens, suppose, actually, I think it costs a couple of bucks to go to the boat show, but suppose it's free. And I take my kids to the boat show, and we look around, and I, you know, look at these boats I can't afford. Invitee, licensee, trespasser, what's my status? What's your guess? Is Sharp? Okay, suppose I'm bored. I'm supposed to be grading exams, but I'm bored. I want to go over to CompUSA. My wife's nowhere close to giving me permission to get a new laptop, but, you know. I want to go there. Invitee, licensee, what's my status? I think I'm an invitee there. Even though I don't at that moment, if you ask me, do you have, particularly if my wife asked me, do you have a present intention to buy anything? My answer would be, no, I don't, honest, really. But looking at it from the owner's standpoint, even if the Hacienda Mexican restaurant or B. Dalton Books or whatever were told, I called them up and I said, hey, I'm just meeting a friend, but I told him I'd meet him at the history section of your bookstore. Oh, sure. Or I say, I'm thinking of coming to the boat show. I don't really, you know, I can't afford a new boat, but I'd love to look at these things. Can I come? They would say, of course. It's to their business interest to have you there. Mr. Stubbs?
What about, you know, when these, like Best Buy have these free hot dogs and soda if you come into our store? And
they give you money to come. Doesn't that tell you that?
As a social guest. Could you say that that's a social guest? Because they're having this big party and you're just going.
But remember, most people who are selling things have the idea that if I can just get you here. In fact, they would probably, a true salesman or woman, would look at me at the boat show and say, I know you didn't come here planning to buy a boat, but give me a half an hour, and, you know, I'll figure out, I can make it possible. Let me run a credit check here. Let me, you know, 0% finance. We can make this happen. So, again, from the owner's standpoint, they want traffic. They want people looking at their stuff, salivating over it. Running home to say, well, I know we don't think we have the budget for it, but why not? So if the business owner has such an interest, as you're pointing out, that they're ready to give away free food just to get people in here, how could it not be that a person going there nominally for some collateral purpose like meeting a friend or keeping their kids from destroying everything else in the house on a soggy February Saturday morning, you know, again, you're probably too stingy vis-a-vis the owner if you think the only time the owner owes a duty of reasonable care is when somebody has the cash in hand and goes to the place intending to buy something. The owner's business purpose is a little more generous than that. Okay, so again, the court says he's a business visitor. What about Hostick? Page 14. Mr. Nelson.
A lady goes with her 17-month-old child to the laundromat, the Queen-O laundromat, and while they're there washing and drying and doing the clothes, the little girl kind of wanders off and finds a little hot water valve and turns it on and calls herself pretty bad.
Okay. And, of course, the question is, what is the little kid's status there? The mother's status is easy, but with respect to the kid, what's the kid's status?
And the trespass. I mean, little kids don't go to wash their clothes there, so it's just kind of...
The kid has bare permission, according to the defendant. Obviously, the plaintiff wants to qualify this kid with a higher status. And what would be the plaintiff's argument as to why this kid deserves the status of an invitee?
Parents pretty regularly take their kids to do laundry, and you can't really leave them at home while you go do the laundry. Part of the game.
Okay, so part of it sort of, did the owner expect this? Did this come as some surprise? It'd be one thing if you had a kid at some other kind of, you know, an aircraft mechanics shop or something, as opposed to a laundromat. It's pretty common for parents to bring their kids. But does it serve a business purpose? What business purpose does it serve for the kid to be there?
Yeah. You can't take your kid with you when you're not going.
No kiddie, no washy. So, again, if you think too narrowly, gee, I can make an argument as to why the kid's a mere licensee, well, wait a minute. Again, ask yourself the question, if you called up the owner of the laundromat and said, well, I'm coming down there, I'd like to come down there and do some laundry, but I got my 2-year-old with me. Oh, sure. You know, duh. Well, can I bring my kid with me? Well, of course. Now, again, it might be different if you were going to an aircraft mechanic place where you're aircraft engine is being overhauled. Oh, I want to bring my 2-year-old. Well, that's a little more uncommon. And what would that look like? We hadn't had that experience before. But here, obviously, it's something where it's an easy, relatively easy connection to make. Does the owner benefit from the child's purpose? Absolutely. Okay. Finally, Mr. Guilford. I happen to have just got in the mail, the Yale Law Report here, so I'm very much in tune with my old alma mater here. Mr. Guilford. Anybody want to tell me about Mr. Guilford? This is boys behaving badly, not girls behaving badly. Okay, go ahead, Mr. Gallagher. I'll draw part of this, not the whole. Substitute, therefore,
and he's informed that he can re-enter the building, but if not, he's looking for a little more rustic circumstance, and proceeds to what appears to be a shaded area where he believes there's a small, a fairly short shrub or a bush which will serve the purpose, and instead we have the arrangement to be drawn on the board. There's a parapet and a beyond that is actually a reasonably tall tree, and such that one can fall over the edge of that and into a lower level, which he needs to do.
And so, of course, the question is, what's his status at the time he suffers this injury? The university's claim is what? Yeah. Because he's no longer within the area to which this invitation was extended. What's his claim? Okay. And on what basis would he claim that his invitation extended not just to the place where the reunion was being held, not just to the facilities within this building, but after the building was closed, that it was left to him to try to find some place to answer the call of nature. Ms. Russell? Okay. Was his state of intoxication one that they could anticipate?
Yeah.
Not only anticipate but encourage.
Yeah.
That the university would encourage him to wax nostalgic and so forth. Would you also think that the university would be fussy about where he chose to wander? No. No, again, the university would kind of encourage these alums to think of the place as alma mater, you know, and wander around, see if that old frat house is still there, see if the whatever it is the way they remember it. So, again, from the standpoint of figuring out, did Guilford go someplace that the university didn't want him to go? The answer is, well, that's certainly a question for the jury. What do you think the jury said? Yeah. You think they would find for him and award him damages against the university? Yeah, they did. And the court upheld it. Jury question. Jury, like Mr. Guilford, believed his version of things, thought he was entitled to a recovery. Now, before you started this section, you might have had a much different attitude. Guilford states his case, and you think, gee, this is like those cocktail party stories about what's wrong with the tort system. Mr. Guilford gets damages from the university because he's doing this and gets hurt? I don't think so. But when you break it down and start saying, okay, let's think about this for a moment. What is the duty that they owe him? What's his status? You know, who decides this? Is this a jury question? And under the circumstances, they say, he's acting reasonably. They're getting the benefit of this kind of, you know, of his... Of the reunion behavior, and so they rightfully are made to pay when he gets injured for failing to sort of alert him to this potential danger. Now, the jury has to like Mr. Gilbert. It'd be real easy for the jury to say, hey, buddy, you were out of line. It's your fault. It's not the university's fault. And go home. But again, it's a jury question, and in a little bit like the WASP case, you have to recognize these are the sorts of things about which jurors are going to form their own judgment. And you have to be prepared to take the jury's verdict for better or for worse. Okay? So... again, kind of calibrating your system here, as I said before, if you start, you know, if your basic disposition on these cases is to kind of see it from the defendant's standpoint, and your instinct is to figure out ways for the defendant to beat the rap, well, you certainly want to argue those. But you want to recognize that the standard may be such that the plaintiff can meet it. And similarly, if you start with the idea you're all fired up for the plaintiffs, you can find a way that the plaintiff certainly gets to the jury, but in the end, the jury's going to have to make that finding that the plaintiff got injured through a lack of reasonable care. Or if it's merely a social guest, the plaintiff's going to have to meet that standard that the defendant failed to warn of a hidden peril. Mr. Cleveland? Maybe, but I think it'd be harder to suggest that this was a hidden peril. I mean, it could be. You might get to the jury on that basis, but I think it's... I'd much rather be in the position of saying it's a lack of reasonable care, which is where he wound up. So again, these are just sort of sampler cases here to give you a feel for it. Now... we have many miles to go before we sleep here. We're here we are in chapter 8. That gives us 3 days next week. So we probably should motor here. What I think I want to do here is make sure we get through attractive nuisance today. And we'll still have this section on... when premises liability categories apply, but I'll do that relatively quickly on Monday. You may even have time for them today, but I doubt it because it'll take us a while to do this section on attractive nuisance. But again, before we get there, any questions about the way in which these categories work, how they're applied? The way in which they're fairly fact-specific. Okay, so there's a little asterisk here that you have to put on the trespasser category that makes an exception for trespassing children. Children get the benefit of this doctrine, commonly known, somewhat misleadingly known, as attractive nuisance. It's neither a nuisance, per se, nor is it really necessarily attractive, but that's sort of the shorthand label that it's been given. We start with sort of a photographic negative here, Osterman versus Peters, showing you what the world would look like if you didn't have the doctrine of attractive nuisance. So can somebody tell us about Osterman? Mr. Rose. Based upon, okay, because at this point, and so far as I know, even today, Maryland does not recognize an exception to this classification based on attractive nuisance. Nonetheless, the plaintiff wants to establish liability anyway, and the plaintiff has a couple of arguments here. What are those arguments? Okay. Essentially, the inability of the child to be found culpable in any sense. The child's innocent at this point. What's the court's answer to that? It's not about the child's guilt. This is not a finding that the plaintiff was at fault. The whole point is that when we say that someone is a trespasser, we're saying that they didn't have permission. And if they don't have permission, then they're a trespasser. So it's not a matter of proving some wickedness on the part of the visitor. It's simply saying, did they have permission? No. If so, they're a trespasser. What else did the plaintiff want to argue? Pardon? Okay, it's actually sort of a reverse allurement doctrine. They're saying that the child wasn't allured. It'd be one thing if the child were going there, seeing this water, and wanted to go splash around in the pool, but the child was there only to retrieve a ball. First response to that is? Huh? You know, if we had an attractive nuisance doctrine, you'd need to prove allurement, at least in some jurisdiction, but we don't have an attractive, so the fact that they were, you know, sort of double negative, I don't know where that's going, but they essentially say the purpose of the child's trespass is irrelevant again. What else does the plaintiff want to argue here? Okay. What does the court say to that? Yeah, criminal indifference in the sense that, you know, suppose you did have a pool of sulfuric acid and you saw the kid heading toward it or whatever. Maybe there are cases where the defendant's conduct was so egregious, the passivity in face of this looming tragedy was so unbelievable. But they cite a lot of other cases where defendants did stuff, kids got into trouble, and the court said, sorry, that's not willful and wanton conduct. There's no intent here. There's no recklessness. It's just, hey, they forgot to secure this gate to the pool. What's the last argument? Yeah. There's a statute that says, thou shalt have a locked gate. And the gate was not locked. It was secured only by a stone or something that's holding this thing shut. It's supposed to have a self-closing gate to prevent kids like this from being able to get in. What's the court's answer to that argument? A statutory violation, we know, can help establish negligence, but the problem here is not that we can't decide whether these people behaved as reasonably prudent people. The problem is we're not sure they even owe a duty of reasonable care. Negligence is relevant if the standard is reasonable care, but we've decided the standard is not reasonable care. Now, There's actually a more difficult question here, which goes to other classes and other sorts of issues, which has to do with when you can imply from a statutory command a cause of action. And this is, you find it in constitutional law and elsewhere. When, for example, the Fourth Amendment to the Constitution says the government can't break into your home and conduct an unreasonable search and seizure, the question is, well, does that constitutional protection give rise to a remedy? If someone is the victim of an unreasonable search and seizure, what remedy do they have? And so when the legislature says, in this case, thou shalt have a self-closing gate on a pool, does that sort of create a remedy? And the court winds up saying, no, it doesn't. Creates a fine. You know, there's an enforcement mechanism. There might even be a thing for negligent homicide, for all I know. There might be some sort of criminal aspect to this. But it doesn't give rise to a civil case. So, again, as I say, that's a little bit beyond the scope of this particular issue about when a statutory command implies a cause of action to remedy it. But the court says it doesn't. Now, again, the function of this case is simply to demonstrate that if we didn't have an attractive nuisance doctrine, we couldn't get to cases like this. We couldn't get to the railroad, the turntable case. We couldn't get to Britt versus Stout. Or no, Britt versus whatever that is, the chemical company. Because we need some doctrine that says, in effect, children get treated differently. And that comes up in Hofer versus Meyer. So in Hofer versus Meyer, beginning on page 18, we have a case in which the court utilizes a test for trespassing children, recognizes a case for attractive nuisance. And let me just tell you about this, because time is not on your side here. The restatement, essentially the kid is left at home one day and wanders over to the neighbor's property. They have a horse. The child is found unconscious inside the fenced area where this horse is kept. The plaintiff files a claim against the owner of the horse saying, in effect, you had an attractive nuisance and you didn't maintain the fenced area around the horse in such a way as to keep children from wandering in there. And so the court turns to this restatement test to figure out, which most jurisdictions utilize, it's 339, isn't that the restatement section that they, section 339, and it says that an owner is liable for injuries to a trespassing child caused by an artificial condition on the premises. And the sort of preliminary question is, are we dealing with an artificial condition? Is the horse an artificial condition? And the defendant might respond by saying, no, it's a real horse. But when we say artificial in this context, it's not like an artificial sweetener. A man-made as opposed to something found in nature, we're referring to something that is a result of human intervention. Poisonous snakes may be indigenous to the property, in which case they're not an artificial condition, but if you introduce poisonous snakes to create a Wild West atmosphere or something, it's an artificial condition. So Now, not all jurisdictions take that view. Some jurisdictions take the view that artificial condition refers to something unnatural. So an electrical transformer is artificial, but a steep embankment or a pool of water is not, regardless of whether the steep embankment is created by a bulldozer or whether it's created by natural land formation. Whereas, again, jurisdictions like this one say the idea about artificial condition is, did it result from human intervention? So if you bring a bulldozer in and create a steep embankment, kids are playing at the base of it, and it collapses, the dirt sloughs off and buries the kids alive, the person who created that steep embankment can be liable for an artificial condition, even though it looks just like, or someone who builds a natural-looking lagoon or pond or whatever. Again, Rylands versus Fletcher, you make something, you sort of keep it at your peril. Okay, that's sort of the preamble. Now let's look at the criteria that the restatement looks to. And again, not like the criteria for an abnormally dangerous activity where these are factors to consider, each one of these elements needs to be met. If you fail one of these elements as a plaintiff, you fail the test. You don't get the treatment, you don't get the benefit of this rule. You've got to meet each one of these to succeed. The first one is that the owner knows of the children's trespass. That is, there's some reason to think that children will trespass in this area. If you're out in the middle of nowhere, not accessible to anything where kids would be, this test wouldn't apply. But if there's some reason you have to believe that the children will be found on your property, then we go to the next step. The owner knows of a grave danger. It's not blackberry bushes where if you fall into the blackberry bushes, you'll get all scraped up or you'll get poison oak or some other kind of thing. This is something like a 14,000 volt electric line or a pool of sulfuric acid or a piece of machinery that could chomp your arm off. So again, some grave injury that's posed by this condition. Third, that the children, because of their youth, are unaware. And again, the idea is we don't protect adult trespassers from their folly, but we do protect children who, because of their youth, are unaware of the danger. Again, that would be a judgment call as to when it is their youth that is to blame. Fourth, and I'm just going to summarize this, it's a cheap fix. I usually tease this out a little more and get people to tell me that the fourth criterion is sort of the learned hand test. But it's not the learned hand test. It's a comparison between the burden on the owner and the measure of risk, but it's not an even balance. It says the burden on the owner is slight compared to this grave danger. All we're talking about is a padlock, a new spring on that self-closing door, a sign that says warning, hazardous chemicals, or electric current or something. So this applies where the owner has an easy way. There's a cheap fix. And then finally, owner fails to implement cheap fix. So even if I meet all the rest of these, I show that there's a pool. The owner knows that kids will break into that pool if they can. The owner knows that kids could drown in the pool. The owner knows that the kids are 5 and 6 years old and are not quite aware of the danger. There's a cheap fix. I just need a new spring for that gate so it'll self-close, and I've got to get a padlock for it. I'm planning to pick one up on my way home from work tomorrow night. If I'm using reasonable care to implement that cheap fix, I'm not liable. For a jury, obviously, to consider, but notice that while we allow cases where the owner can be held liable, it's a fairly rigorous gauntlet that we make the plaintiff run. So if I'm working on, you know, I got power tools in my garage, there are kids that play around in my neighborhood, they're sort of in and out of my house, or, you know, they're coming up to me trying to sell me lemonade and so forth and so on. I've got a power saw there, all kinds of stuff. Do I close the garage door before I leave to run an errand to get a new bit for my drill? If closing the garage door would be that cheap fix to alleviate that substantial risk, I could be held liable. But you got to run through each of these and say, was there a, you know, can the plaintiff satisfy that test? They say, on Monday, we're going to pick up with the question, how do we differentiate those cases where we apply the peculiar standards of premises liability from the cases where we say, oh no, that's not relevant to this case. So we'll pick up there on Monday.